Hi there, it's Tracy Zemiska again, and I'm here with my good friend Rachel Land. She is a yoga teacher in New Zealand, and I met her through my yoga medicine training. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Oh, great. It's lovely to have you. I just wanted to get started. If you want to talk about your yoga journey, where did you start doing yoga, why, and what kept you coming back?
Good question. I started practicing as a teenager. I would have been 12 or 13, and I started going with my mum to some local classes in a church hall. And I don't even remember whether I enjoyed them or not. I don't remember much about the practice except that I think it was Iyengar influence. So it was slow and alignment oriented. Definitely not as strong as practices today, and I don't remember any flow other than some salutations. So I don't remember thinking, oh my God, this is it, I love yoga. It just became sort of part of the background of my life. So I practiced on and off with local teachers and then by myself at home. And once I got a bit older and then started traveling, that's the way my practice progressed. It was mostly just me on a mat at home. This is making me sound really old. This is in the days before YouTube, in the days before Yoga Glow. So I just practiced the stuff that I remembered from my classes, and it was all really basic. You know, I don't even remember stepping forward from down dog. It was just sun salutations, coming up to standing, and then stepping back to a standing posture. And it wasn't until about, let's see, maybe 8 or 10 years ago that I moved to Queenstown in New Zealand. I had been traveling in the States and Canada, moved here to New Zealand and started going to yoga classes at my local gym. And it was then that I started noticing how much either yoga had changed or just the style that I was practicing now was different. And it was a bit more interesting, a bit more athletic, more physically challenging. And so I found the practice much more interesting then. It made me work a bit harder. I was quite flexible, but I had to work really hard to be strong and to create stability. So I found it more interesting. I started practicing more often. And then it would have been 5, maybe 6 years ago that one of the teachers at that gym said, there's yoga teacher training coming to town, and I think you should do it. And I remember at that time just being terrified. I thought, she's right, I have to do that teacher training. You know, I love yoga. I've been practicing on and off now for years, and I keep coming back to it no matter where I've been in the world and what I've been doing for work. I've kept coming back to it. She's right, I've got to do that training. But I was terrified, so nervous, but I found it. I signed up for it. And the year between finding out about the training and doing the training, I practiced every single day. I did quite a bit of reading and research, so it was still a lot of it self-taught. I was practicing by myself most of the time. I remember the night before the teacher training, I was literally sick. I was so nervous, which is funny looking back, because that 4-week intensive was probably the best 4 weeks of my life. It was literally life-changing, life-altering. I came out the other end, graduated, taught a 90-minute class the next day with the studio owner sitting at the back of the room with a clipboard taking notes while I taught. And then taught 2 classes the next week, and then 3 classes the next week, and then 4 classes the week after. And after about 6 months, dropped a couple of days of my full-time work, and then dropped another day, and then I became a full-time teacher about 2.5 years ago. So it was a really interesting process, terrifying for me to be putting myself out there. to be, I had always worked behind the scenes. I'd always been, you know, admin or up in a back room somewhere. So for me to be the person at the front of the room, I found quite terrifying. And even to be doing a job where I was putting myself out there in something that was important to me, I found quite terrifying. But I'm really excited that I did, because it's as if the more scary I found it, the more I grew and the more people responded to me putting myself out there. So that was, the teacher training was 5 years ago. And as I said, I'm now a full-time teacher. I do nothing but, people often ask what my hobbies are. I really don't have any. It's pretty much just yoga all the time. And that's me, group classes, workshops, private classes, and I'm just starting to run retreats now. And that's pretty much all I do all day long.
That's awesome. I do want to say, don't let me forget to talk about your retreats, because I think there's still spaces available.
There's a couple of spots. Yeah, it's only a small retreat. This is the swimming with yoga and swimming with the whales in Tonga.
Yeah,
it's a pretty small group. We only wanted 5 to 7, so we've got a couple of spots left. But we're, you know, we've got enough to go ahead anyway. We're definitely heading to Tonga soon. But yeah, we can talk about that at the end.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, because I want to include that for people. If anyone, I would love to do that at some point. I hope you do this again so that I can save my money and
it's
come.
It's a real bucket list thing. So many people have said to me, you know, I can't come this year, but it's on my list of things I have to do before I die. I've got to swim with the whales. And it does, it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it. Kind of scary, but also sort of epic and beautiful and adventurous and exciting.
Yeah. One of the things that I would love, if you feel comfortable talking more about this, I mean, I don't know a ton of yoga teachers. Obviously, I know a bunch in my community here and then all of our friends and family from yoga medicine. But I have found you to be probably the most introverted yoga teacher that I've ever met. And
that's
so I wonder,
interesting.
Do you not feel that way about yourself?
No, I'm definitely very introverted. I mean, you know, when I'm teaching a class, I'll be joking around and I often get a bit of motor mouth going on. I just say whatever comes into my head, and sometimes that's awesome and sometimes it's terrible. But definitely it takes me a lot of energy to step up and be at the front of the room and to talk to a group. And I always need to come back and have time by myself or time walking the dog to recharge my batteries.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm shy, but being with people, even though I find it really enjoyable and inspiring, takes my energy. And I need to come home and recharge the batteries before I can do that again. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine your classes, because you're very funny. Like, one of my favorite things about you, I think that you're hysterical. You always have something really witty and clever to say. So I can only imagine.
I definitely talk a bit of crap. That's for sure. I sometimes too much. You know, if I'm teaching a 6:30 in the morning class, people aren't always that into joking. They're really just waking up. But, yeah. If it's a more energetic group of people or it's a little bit later in the day, then, yeah, I do probably talk a little bit too much trash. But that's just how it is. I couldn't change that if I tried, so I'm not going to try.
Yeah, no, I think you're wonderful.
But yeah,
exactly the way you are.
Oh, bless. Thank you.
So do you find, especially in teaching, do you have, like, a favorite type, I guess? Like, do you prefer the privates over teaching classes? Like, I find myself, I really enjoy doing workshops. It's probably one of my favorite things. I love working one-on-one, but I probably am my best and I probably shine best, and I think I help people more at workshops. That's kind of my favorite way of teaching.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think at this point in my teaching, I need variety. Like, I love private sessions because we can actually make a difference. We can make changes in people's posture. We can improve the quality of their life. But if I only did privates, I don't know that I'd be completely satisfied. And I love group classes because the energy that you get in a room full of people all, you know, flowing at the same time and all connected is incredible. I find that quite uplifting and energizing. But I couldn't do that all the time because it can be frustrating teaching a group of people and not seeing changes and talking and not seeing the cues translate to any differences in their posture or alignment. And I love workshops, but I also don't know that I could do that all of the time because they take a lot of thought. There's a lot of, you know, mental preparation in running a workshop. So I think for me, finding the right balance between different types of teaching is what makes the career enjoyable for me. And also teaching online, you know, writing and posting videos on Facebook and Instagram. I'm finding that a really useful balance to teaching people face-to-face.
I love your videos, by the way. I love your videos. They're always great.
They're really good fun. And even just learning the technical skills of how to use phone, computer programs, that's been really fun. But to go back to answering your question, I'm definitely better at teaching people who want to learn. Probably where I shine the least is a class where, and I've only had a couple of privates along these lines, usually it's group classes where people really, they just want to come, they want to have a nice time, they don't want to think too hard or learn too much, and then they want to go home. And that's probably where I am the worst as a teacher because my passion is learning. And so I want to teach and I want people to walk away with something fresh or new or a different perspective. And if that's not what they're looking for, I think they could find that frustrating. Maybe I'd just be talking at them.
Yeah.
So I definitely shine best when I have an opportunity to teach to people who are interested in learning.
So I think, too, you know, the way that just our 500 hour and, you know, the way that Tiffany teaches, I think that we probably all have very similar teaching styles as a result of, you know, watching her and having her train us. But I think also you have to have that desire not only to learn and to grow as a teacher, but to educate people about their bodies and how they work. You know, unfortunately, just putting people in the poses and not being able to take time to talk about why they're there and what they should be feeling and how to feel more, you know, that whole process takes time. So it's important that you have a class that is open to kind of hanging out longer in the poses and that sort of thing.
And I think the compromise that I've tried to find is, and Tiffany's so brilliant at this, maybe I'll just be focusing on one thing, one theme for the class. And so I see people doing all kinds of things that are a bit crazy in their Warrior 2 or in their Chaturanga, but that's okay. We'll let that slide for today and we'll focus on core and how we engage the core and when the spine is neutral and when the spine is not neutral. And that to me has given me the most freedom to teach regular classes where I'm not over-examining everything, but they do walk away having learned one or two new things. But you're right, her teaching style definitely lends itself more to either workshop style or longer holds in postures, and not everybody wants to learn. Some people just want to play, and some people just want to do advanced postures. They don't want to look at, you know, examining how to do the basics right. They just want to get to a forearm stand or, you know, an overhead bind or whatever the thing is that they're working on.
Yeah, one of the poses that I find that in, and I will, you know, even when I'm teaching advanced classes, I always will ask them not to go into the full posture, is side angle, because I'm always trying to activate, you know, the hips and the deeper muscles in the hip. And no matter, I mean, there's always one person, it seems, that I will say forearm to the thigh, and they'll put their hand down on the ground. And I'm like, okay, do whatever you want, but you're not going to feel it. And that's okay. So
it's
I understand what you're
thing,
saying.
Isn't it? It really is tough to see people who always want to go to step B when they haven't done step A yet. And you kind of go, God, have you just – this is one thing that I really value from the way that my yoga practice has progressed, and that is that – I'm still pretty basic in my practice. I can do a couple of fancy postures, but I've been practicing for 27 odd years, and most of that time I didn't even know that you could step forward from downward facing dog. I'd never heard of arm balances. So even though that side of practice has made it more interesting to me, I spent a good solid 20 years just on Tadasana, on sun salutations on Downward Facing Dog and on Warrior 2. And I just wish that everybody would have the same opportunity to spend time on the basics before they rush ahead.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, but and I even find... No, we're not that way.
I want to do it now. I remember I had a student a couple of years ago, and she said, why can't I get that overhead bind and pigeon yet? And I said, give it time. And she said, I've been practicing for 3 months. Why can't I get it yet? And I was like, 3 months? give it time. I mean, years is what I mean by give it time. Give it time. Let it unfold. Let it develop. Don't force it. Don't rush it. But that's not a popular sentiment. You know, people want it now. They want to do it now.
Yeah, and I think one of my favorites, I'm not into the whole, like, showy Instagram stuff. I think, like your videos are helpful videos. They're helpful for most practitioners. People learn from watching the videos that you put up on Instagram. And there's some people who put things up that, you know, they're really advanced postures and whatever. And I think that's great, except as a teacher, it scares the hell out of me because, like, hollow back handstand is one of the things I hate the most. I look at that and I think this pose is going to hurt people, especially if you don't have a strong core and you don't know what the hell you're doing. And there's a lot of young women especially who are super bendy and flexible who can figure out how to get there and should not be doing it. But so I always get really concerned when people are like, oh, I saw this on Instagram. I'm like, oh, great. I'm going to have like, this person fall over in my class or something. But Kino McGregor, what's that?
Yeah, first we have to unteach a whole heap of stuff, and then maybe we start moving toward that.
Yeah, exactly. And Kino McGregor, I know a lot of people don't particularly care for her, but she put one of her videos that she put up, which is a fantastic illustration, is her to crow to handstand to plank. And she, you know, put a video up of that whole sequence there, which is a famous one for Ashtanga. And I, you know, have dealt with a lot of Ashtanga practitioners over the years. And she then posted in the comments that it took her over 7.5 years to be able to perfect that sequence. And I think it's so helpful that she did that because I will say that now, like I will reference that now and say this person who is seen as, you know, this leading teacher in the United States and this expert in this style, it took her 7 years of continuous practice to get there.
Practicing 90 minutes a day, 6 days a week. I mean, Ashtangis are dedicated. Mm-hmm. So it's not a casual, you know, oh, I'll come back and have a look at that in a couple of months. That's 7 years of dedicated practice.
Yeah. So no, I do the same thing.
I really like Kino McGregor, and I agree with you. She posts some really fancy pictures, but the comments, the text is always, it gives you a feeling of the depth, the background, the level of dedication that it takes for her to get there. It's never just a throwaway line. She'll always talk about, what it's taken her to get there. And Instagram is a really challenging thing for yoga. I'm still very new to it. I've only been on Instagram for the last 6 months, and I'm still finding it a massive challenge to balance what people respond to, you know, what they like, what they comment on, versus what I think is an accurate reflection of my practice and my teaching. And it's tough. So I try to balance out postures that are simple, that are basic, that I teach in every single class, with the ones that look a bit more exciting that I can do. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. And I agree with you. I think that Instagram is challenging in so many ways. But when just quickly going back to Kino for a second, one of the things that I also really like about her, and she posted this once, she's always smiling in every picture. I remember she commented about that, you know, just because she smiles all the time, like she forces herself to smile whether she's in a good mood or not, because she wants to, she overall loves her life and loves being a yoga teacher and loves practicing, and she wants that to shine through all the time. And, you know, having been trained in Ashtanga and having practiced it for a while, I read her book a few years ago, and she was the first person who ever gave me permission not to be a vegetarian. And I felt like, Oh my gosh. If Keena McGregor says I don't have to be a vegetarian, then I definitely don't have to be one. And I'm still a good yoga teacher.
It's probably okay.
Right.
It's an interesting thing in the yoga world, isn't it? We're supposed to be sort of free-thinking and free-spirited, but there is a culture within yoga that suggests that we should all be a certain way, that we should all be vegan, that we should all be spiritual, that we should avoid physical possessions, and that we should avoid financial comfort. And yet the reality is we're all different. You know, we've all got our own path to take. Different things are important to us. I'm definitely not vegetarian. I grew up vegetarian. I didn't eat any meat until I was about 18 or 19, but these days I do. And I don't think yoga is about us judging each other's choices. It's about giving each other the space to make our own choices and to be comfortable with those.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And this has actually come up a bunch in the podcast. And even after, like when I will speak to people after we finish recording, is this idea of judginess in yoga and how, where does it come from and why is it happening? And I often will say, like, when we are talking about each other, we probably are one of, as a cohort, one of the judgiest groups of individuals that exists. And it makes no sense, right?
That said, though, you'd be the same as me, I'm sure, that I tend to be drawn to groups of yogis that accept me. And so mm-hmm. I love the yoga medicine family because there's very little competition and there's, I think, very little judginess there. It's a pretty interesting group of yogis. It's not about achievement or sort of outward appearance. It's really about being of service, being of helpful to others. So I love the yoga medicine attitude. And here in my local community, yoga is growing here in Queenstown so rapidly, but the local crew of teachers are really supportive. We back each other really well and have most of us teach at multiple studios. So I think that helps. There's not this crowd and that crowd. We all pretty much teach everywhere. And so that's the kind of yogi community that I'm drawn to, the one where you can be yourself as long as you're being thoughtful about it, as long as you're being mindful about it, you can do what you want.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree with you. And, I noticed that when I moved to the community I live in now, it's much different than the one that I was in before. And it's not this competition, fear-based place. It's very inclusive and people are very supportive. Mm. And so I've enjoyed that. And there's a lot of different styles of teaching. I will say, though, I feel like down here, there are a lot more, spiritually based teachers that aren't so much about the asana and doing it a certain way, per se. And I do struggle. Like, my teacher training was very asana based. I mean, I had to, and it was very Sanskrit based because it was an Ashtanga based program. So I had to know all the Sanskrit for the poses. I had to know how to count in Sanskrit. I had to be able to lead, the primary series and things like that. And there wasn't as much of the philosophy, spiritual side of teaching when I took my teacher training. And I think that that's probably, as a person, I think I'm very spiritual. But that's probably one area that I really lack in terms of, like, I've never read all of the sutras. I've read a few of them. But I've never had to do a sutra study. There was very little. We talked about, we had a philosophy teacher from a local college come in to teach the philosophy part of it. So he taught Buddhism and Hinduism. And that was about it. We learned about that, but there was nothing else really on the other end of that. So, for me, and I think that's one of the things that I really liked about Tiffany too. And it's not that I think being spiritual in yoga is hokey, because I don't, and I do read things that I think are meaningful and can be, kind of perceived as like hippy-dippy stuff, but one of the things that drew me to Tiffany was that she was so physically based, but she was still able to get you to be in that place where you felt what it feels like what the spiritual side of yoga feels like. Like, she can still get you there when you're laying in Shavasana. You can still have those moments, even though the majority of what you guys are doing in her classes is really body-centric and alignment-centric.
I think she's really intelligent in her sequencing and her cueing, in that she'll pick, you know, she's got a physical focus for the class, an anatomical focus, and she'll weave into that an element of philosophy. And it may not be based on traditional yogic philosophy. It might be an element of modern Western philosophy, or just a concept like stability, or whatever, truth or openness. And she weaves that in a way that you feel like you're discovering it for yourself, as opposed to her telling you or giving you information. And I found that really inspiring, because definitely, you know, you picked up, I'm quite an introvert. So in my teaching style, I don't feel comfortable telling people, you know, this is how I think you should think, or this is how I think you should feel. I feel much more comfortable trying to create an environment where I want them to explore. Here's a concept I want you to have a look at, or have a think about, or have a feel into. So, yeah, I found my exposure to her teaching very inspiring, in terms of it being a pathway that doesn't need you to be a personality as a teacher. You can be yourself, and you're just creating a safe space for your students to explore a particular concept or a particular direction. And hopefully they'll find inspiration from within, as opposed to you having to provide it from the outside.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, and I always talk about this, you know, with my students too. For me, yoga is all about empowerment. And the way that I use it to reach people is, what I have found on my own personal practice and from my own experiences on the mat, and then also as a teacher, when I have people that I've worked with for several years, what I have found is that the more that you get people in their bodies and feeling their bodies and being able to identify how they're feeling, what they're feeling when they do certain things, it makes them then more connected to everything else that they need. Like, they're able to identify and verbalize their needs. They are able to become a better advocate for themselves, and they're able to discount and ignore everything that's outside of who they are. And I think that,
100%.
You know, I think that's one of the things that really drew me. I like her athleticism too. Like, that's always, I've always found her classes challenging, and I enjoy that. I enjoy being physically challenged. And it's because she has such complicated sequencing, which I really like. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I just think that we have this opportunity as yoga teachers to, especially with women, and culturally it might be a little bit different where you live, but here, and I think it's like this all over the world, obviously I'm not that cultured to know this, but I think that women especially are given this model of, you should always be of service and you should always be self-sacrificing, and if you aren't doing those things, then you're a bad woman, and that means you're a bad wife, and you know, you're a bad mother, whatever. And so there's this huge level of guilt, I think, that comes along with really being in tune with yourself, because the more you get to know your needs, the more you go inside, the less you're concerned about everybody else's needs around you. Like, you know that it's personal responsibility to take care of oneself, especially as an adult, and that you aren't responsible for making people happy, and you aren't responsible for leading them down this path. Like, everyone has to find their own way. And when you give people permission to start focusing on themselves and their own path, especially women, they do become better partners and mothers and teachers, and because they know themselves more. And, you know, so it's very liberating, I think, for women especially to find yoga and to be in that place, you know, where they can become their own best friend.
I really agree. And I think I've seen it time and time again, people come to yoga for a superficial reason. You know, I'm too tight. My neck gets sore from working, or my hamstrings are really short, and I want to practice regularly so that I become more flexible. And yet, if they practice regularly and they practice consistently with a level of mindfulness, they can't help but change. I mean, this has happened to me, and I've seen it happen to hundreds of students. It doesn't matter what reason you come for. If you're practicing thoughtfully, it cannot help but change you. And I did a really interesting program last year, a mentoring program called Enhances Awareness, or EAP, and it talks about the body as a symbol of consciousness. To me, the program was such a perfect adjunct to yoga because it's all about walking through your life being more aware. And it helps me understand why when people come to yoga and they really make themselves present in the postures, they can't help but change. And when they are more aware of themselves, their feelings, their motives, their drives, they cannot help but walk out being better for their partners, their families, their colleagues, the world. It's as if service is a really natural outflowing of being comfortable with yourself as a person.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the reason that is that you almost like you, I don't think that you're necessarily able to give of yourself until, you know, in a really selfless way, in a really serving way. I don't know that you can really be of service to other people until you get to that place of self-awareness, because you don't necessarily know what your gifts are. You know, you don't know how you can serve people.
Or you're giving from a place of wanting, whether it's approval or, you know, or to remove guilt. Or whereas when you feel full in what you've achieved or what you're accomplishing in your life, when you feel like you're walking in the right direction, it just seems to be easier to open up and to give to other people. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think rather than starting with the point of view of serving others, we start from the point of view of serving ourselves. And it becomes a really natural outflowing. It becomes a really easy process as opposed to something we have to force ourselves to do.
Yeah. And I think that's what's great about yoga, though, too, is that I think it helps people also build that self-nurturing sort of practice at some point. You realize, like, what your needs are.
I was saying my theme for this week in my classes was transition because I'm moving house and I always teach what I need to learn. So I was teaching about transition and as I was kind of formulating my classes and doing my research, it made me think that when I see someone in my class that I think is an expert or an advanced yogi, even just in the asana practice, it's not because of the postures that they do. Because quite often the teachers or the strongest yogis are the ones who move more slowly or stop and rest or modify because they're looking after an injury. So it's not that they're doing everything. It's that whatever they do, they're doing with full awareness and full presence and with grace and with beauty. And it's just made me think about whether that translates off the yoga mat and into life as well, that it's not how much we're achieving or how far we're going in life, but the level of presence and mindfulness that we put into what we do that makes our lives different or special or meaningful. It's been
a
really interesting thought. But yeah, you're right. The more people practice, the more it's sometimes the less they do. You know, you'll see people early on in practice killing themselves, trying to do everything and tick every posture off and breathe the deepest and on the loudest. And then it's as if as the practice matures, they go, maybe I don't need to work that hard today. Maybe I don't need to push that extra little bit today. Maybe today if I just take a step back, I'll be a little bit more open to grace. It's a really interesting process to observe, isn't it?
Definitely. And that's one of the things that I love of seeing people's practice. Like I'll have a student that will come in who is new to my class. And, you know, obviously you can't always tell how advanced their practice is until you see them moving. And my favorite thing is when I see someone who's really advanced, I can tell, you know, as they move through the sun salutations, the level of practice they have, and that they will take a child's pose instead of whatever we're doing. And I love that because it's also a reminder for me. That's one of the things that when I first started teaching, especially, and I would ask for feedback from people who are my friends or people who were teachers that were taking my class, I would always ask them, like, what can you suggest to make me better? And they would always say to me, don't forget to offer child's pose. Like, you never once offered it the entire class. And I was like, oh. I didn't?
Now, I hate child's pose. I find it desperately uncomfortable. So I often forget to offer child's pose purely because it would be the last place I would want to be.
I think that's the same with me. I've never liked it either. Yeah. It's not been my favorite.
No, I hate it. So I'll say, you know, downward facing dog, or you can pop your knees down, you can take child's pose, or any resting pose of your choice.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be child's pose because I hate that. But yeah, you're right. It's a really good sign, isn't it, when you see someone modifying their practice, it means that they are listening to how they feel as mm-hmm. opposed to going through the motions.
Yeah, definitely.
To me, the enemy of true yoga, whether it's asana or pranayama or meditation or anything, the enemy of yoga is going through the motions. The friend of yoga is mindful attention, diligent practice, but mindfully, not just practicing for practice's sake, but mindfully with awareness. That's the yoga to me. Whatever you're doing, be present in what that is.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think this might just be me, you know, making excuses and letting myself off the hook, but if I teach almost every day of the week, so I might not be doing a full practice on my own, but I might just be demonstrating in class for things. So I'm always on my mat, and I'm always moving on my mat. But to me, yoga is so much more than just asana. And some days it's, oh, today I, you know, spent 15 minutes taking a nap, or I did a yoga nidra today, or I gardened for a few hours, or whatever. Like, for me, yoga yeah. is knowing, like, what I need and giving myself what I yeah. need and being happy about it.
Yeah. Which must have been a challenge for you if you did an Ashtanga-based training where, you know, the practice is quite specific, isn't it? You know, the sequence, you're supposed to do it, you know, frequently, whereas my teacher training was much more hatha vinyasa. Mm-hmm. I don't have that kind of discipline background, and I'm quite glad, actually, because I suspect as an OCD teenager, had I found Ashtanga, mm-hmm. I'd be able to do a heap more stuff now, but I would probably have killed myself. You know, I was the type of kid who was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to walk 30 minutes to the gym, and I'd study while I was walking to the gym, and then I'd do 3 classes in a row, and then I'd study as I was walking home. The last thing I needed was a really disciplined physical yoga practice, so I'm glad I never stumbled on it.
I don't blame you. For me, it was what I needed at the time, and I have a lot of respect for it, and I love it, and you know, it's definitely something that was important to me, and it got me to my teacher training, and that's why I decided to become a teacher. But I am very type A, and I have loads of energy, and if I don't burn through that energy, I can't sleep at night. And I also, you know, had my upbringing was sort of chaotic. My house wasn't always very stable. My dad's an alcoholic, and so it was not – I mean, he's not a violent person, but he's not stable. So as a result, you just never know what you're going to get. And so my life was really kind of, my mom is like super hippie, do what you feel, go with the flow. Like, I needed boundaries. I needed structure. And I didn't have that. You know, so I spent a good while like imposing boundaries on myself and being, you know, that person who was very, you know, structured in my life. And I get into these routines, and that's what makes me feel safe. I mean, I'm one of those people who will eat the same thing for breakfast for, you know, 8 months straight. And if I can't have my same if I can't have my same breakfast, then my day's ruined, you know? Like, I'm one of those people who likes routine. So
that's
for
awesome.
Me, Ashtanga was that. You know, it was, I knew what to expect every single time. I knew what was coming next. There was no surprises. And I needed to have that. And I also feel like because I've evolved in terms of my own relationship with myself, at that time, I needed to punish myself. Like, I needed to go and do this. I needed to feel physically sore and tired to be validated. So I had to do that practice to make myself believe that I was doing something.
I think it's a real sign of maturity as a teacher that you recognize that there is not one right way, and there is not one right practice, not for different people and not for different periods of life. When I first started teaching, I thought, I think like most people fresh out of teacher training do, this is the only right way, and this is the only right path, and everything else is potentially dangerous. Not, I think, because my teachers had that attitude, but just because that was all I knew. I only had my own personal practice and what my teachers had taught me. And I started teaching in a studio that offered Bikram. And I remember for the first couple of months thinking, would, you know, I did a couple of Bikram classes and, oh my goodness, it's so dangerous. But the longer I taught at that studio and the more people I've spoken to, you know, there are people who have had their lives and their health transformed by Bikram or transformed by Yin or transformed by Ashtanga or Shivananda. Or so it doesn't matter what school, it doesn't matter what style, it doesn't matter what temperature or even the little nuances of alignment that I think are important aren't true for everybody. So I think the more mature we become as teachers, the more we accept that there are different strokes for different folks, different paths for different times in your life, and it's quite freeing in some ways.
Definitely, and I think that that just goes along, you know, with what we're talking about of why yoga is so important in people's lives. I think there's something so liberating about yoga, and especially just the simplicity. You know, I'm an asthmatic, and so breathing has always for me my whole life, and that's one of the gifts that yoga gave me, being able to find my breath and to really be able to utilize it. I have a friend who I did one of my podcasts, Melissa, and she talks briefly about her mother. She had an illness that impacted her ability to breathe, and her mother passed away shortly right before Melissa completed her teacher training. And she, one of the things she found in studying and teaching was that she felt almost closer to her mother because of the whole breathing. You know, it was sort of this link, that something her mother was incapable of doing. And, you know, she had to focus so much on it herself. So I just think that it's hard to not. I was just talking to a student the other day. She was saying that she's like, I just am obsessed with yoga, and I've been doing it for, you know, and it, my love of it is not going on.
I feel sorry for my poor boyfriend, because I teach, and as I said earlier, I don't really have many other hobbies. There's not much else I do other than teach, practice, read, think, research yoga. My mum has been practicing yoga since the 60s, and she is now a wellness mentor. She does remedial therapy, but yoga is a pretty deeply entrenched part of her life. Her partner did the same teacher training that I did a year later, so he is now an amazing teacher and remedial therapist. So when the four of us get together, my mum, her partner, my boyfriend, and I, my poor boyfriend spends a lot of time on his phone while we talk about yoga thing and alignment. And, and yeah, my poor partner just plays games on his phone. One thing I did think of earlier that I wanted to talk about, when you were talking about the really simple things like the power of breathing, it made me think that when I first started teaching, I think I taught with a particular style and focus, but once I started teaching privates, it really changed, because my first couple of private clients were older, and they were rehabilitation situations, so they were really practicing yoga not to tick off postures, not to, you know, advance their physical practice, but to be able to put their shoes on, to be able to walk for more than 15 minutes without pain, to be able to drive their car again. And it created a quantum shift in my focus as a teacher and my appreciation for the really simple things like breathing, like mindfulness, like posture. Yeah, and I think I've not been able to help but change the way I teach because of that appreciation. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, you're probably lucky that you had asthma, in the sense that it really made you appreciate how powerful it can be just to breathe smoothly and freely.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've talked about with some other teachers too is the benefit of not being like, I guess, the stereotypical yoga teacher, in terms of being someone who's like very slim and hyper flexible and can do everything and can achieve the poses on a really easy way.
Yeah. I mean, that said, I'm not an ex-dancer, I'm not an ex-gymnast, but I have found that there are plenty of postures that I've been able to do the first time I've tried them, simply, I think, because I've practiced such a long time before I even knew that pose existed.
Right.
So I've been doing writer's arms for 27 years. So when I go to do an overhead bind, oh, I can, because I've been doing writer's arms for that long. So in that sense, I've been really lucky, and I don't have any massive injuries. I don't have any serious health conditions, but I'm also not skinny, and I'm I'm not a hippie, and I'm not a vegan. I definitely like chocolate and all the wicked things in life. So yeah, I think there's a benefit too to not being the stereotypical yogi, because you speak to a different group of people, don't you?
Yes, for sure. And I think it makes people comfortable, you know, and you have a different way of looking at the poses. Like, I understand what it means to struggle in certain poses. And one thing that I always used to do, and this is me, you know, not even realizing I was doing this, but I was being a huge asshole, was that I'd have people, it's true, it's very true. I would have people come to my class, and they would be like, oh, I can't kneel. I can't, you know, my knees bother me. I can't kneel. And I'd ask if they had an injury, and they'd be like, oh, it's just arthritis, or it's just something, you know, they'd have whatever. And I would, you know, in my brain, oh, well, we can give you some blankets and it'll be fine. And I would encourage them to use blankets, and I would encourage them still to be on their hands and knees. And one day I hurt my knee. I had never injured my knee in my life. I have played sports since I was young, and I played tennis all through high school. I've done triathlons. I have run half marathons, sharing there to teach yoga, and I hurt my MCL. It wasn't anything serious, but it took a long time for it to heal. And I learned that sometimes there is no number of props that can help you feel comfortable on your hands and knees. And that's what it took, though, for me to get there and to be like, oh, you can't kneel. Yes.
So when you said you can't kneel, what you meant was you can't kneel.
Right.
No matter how many blankets. Yeah, but you're so right. You can't understand what pain feels like from the outside. You can look at people and go, oh, they just don't look comfortable, but I don't know why. It's only really once you feel it yourself that you go, ah, so not even if I, okay, not even if I, all right. And that's what gets you sort of thinking creatively about what other possibilities there might be. But sometimes you really do need to be injured in order to have that light bulb moment, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that I have found, and I've had other teachers talk to me about this before, and I think that you and I have even spoken about this because you have people that you work with that are like this. One of the things that I found with my students that have chronic pain is that they're often very misunderstood. And people who are in chronic pain are probably the least sympathetic individuals, like in terms of how people are treat them. They are just usually very grumpy, and they're very insistent upon, you know, perpetuating their limitations, and they're very afraid of letting go of their pain. Not consciously, obviously, but they're usually the more difficult client to work with. And they've done all these studies, too. Go on.
I think that's the thing, is pain changes you. So when you're meeting someone who's in chronic pain, you're not always seeing their true personality. You're seeing them through a veil, through a filter of just how much they're able to tolerate. You know, people, we all have coping mechanisms, don't we? And some of the coping mechanisms that people have to use when they're in chronic pain change the way they interrelate with the world. And it can be super challenging to work with clients who are in pain, particularly when the pain is unpredictable. You don't know what causes it. You don't know what makes it worse. You don't know what makes it better. You just have to deal with what presents on the day. It's great experience as a teacher, but it's probably incredibly challenging to be the student.
I also, I don't think it's for everyone. You know, I don't think that there's a level of patience, and you have to be really sympathetic and have a thick skin and not take things personally to be successful working with someone, especially one-on-one, that has chronic pain. And it's unfortunate because I think that they aren't helped as much generally as a population because it's a little bit harder, and it takes time to break through the pain cycle and that chronic pain to reach them and to offer them support and for them to be willing to accept it. I mean, there's a lot of fear that surrounds chronic pain. And, you know, it's that whole idea of like the devil you know is better than the devil that you don't. Because, you know, they don't want to try new things necessarily because they don't know if it's going to cause more pain. I mean, they're very fearful about the way that they live their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, they can be. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess when you think about it, most people's experience of yoga is within a group class setting. And if you're somebody who's living in chronic pain, a group class could be incredibly challenging for you. You know, you're looking at all of these other people who are doing things to outward appearance easily, and you can't do that, you can't do that, that hurts, that creates a flare-up in your shoulder, that creates a flare-up in your neck. So I think one-on-one is definitely the way forward, but it is really tough. And I mean, and I'm really wary of trying new things with people who are in pain because I'm only there for an hour or an hour and a half, and they have to deal with the consequences the whole rest of the day, maybe the next day, maybe the day after. So it's definitely made me more conservative as a teacher, I think, because I feel like tiny, incremental, slow progress is better than trying to challenge things and having them deal with the aftermath when I've gone home. Does that make sense?
Totally, and I agree with you 100%. I think my challenge with people, whether they're in chronic pain or not, especially one-on-one, is stopping them from doing more than 50% effort. Like, I have a guy right now who's, he's in his 70s, and he was in sales, medical equipment sales, for his whole life. So he's obviously very charismatic and outgoing, and but he's also very driven, you know, to be so successful in sales. You have to be very driven. And we're dealing with lots of different things right now with his body. And nothing that's like severe where he can't function, but he just wants to make some changes. And he's very stiff and he feels very out of shape. And he's been working with a personal trainer for about a year and he doesn't really notice any difference. And there's a ton of biomechanical things that we're working on. But one of the things that I've said to him is, you need to do this with 50% effort. And I finally said to him one day, this is the first time in your whole life that someone's not only giving you permission, but the expectation is for you to half-ass something. Like, take advantage of it. Like, that's how you're going to get passing grades here.
This was actually one of the things that came up for me working in the Bikram yoga studio locally, in that the teachers who had come up in the Bikram school of thinking, their general orientation towards students was that students need to be encouraged to work hard. Students, given the opportunity, will take it easy. They'll take the path of least resistance. And your job as a teacher is to put some fire in their belly, to challenge them to step up and to step forward. Whereas the teachers on the other side of the studio who'd come up in Hatha or Vinyasa or more restorative yoga, our orientation was that we see students too often pushing themselves too hard. We see them straining or forcing or hurting themselves, and we think our role as a teacher is to remind them that there should be some element of sukha, you know, some ease about the posture. So in between the two schools of thought, somewhere in the middle is the truth, isn't it? Sometimes you need to have some fire in your belly, and sometimes you need to cool and calm down. Some people definitely lean more towards one side of the spectrum than the other, but the you know, the truth is somewhere in the middle. Sometimes we need someone to kick our ass, and sometimes we need someone to remind us that there needs to be an element of ease there.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree with you. I think that there is something kind of in the middle of it all. And sometimes it's hard to negotiate that place. And
It really is for all of us, I think. And I guess someone who's invested in and committed to private yoga sessions is more likely to be the type A, aren't they? They're more likely to be the type of person who is, you know, I'm going to be doing this 3 times a week, or you're going to do me a program and I'm going to do it every day. So they're already self-selecting themselves as a group that are probably likely to work too hard.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you. I think that's definitely the personality, generally speaking. But I also think, you know, and we've talked about this, you brought this up earlier, this idea of what brings people to the mat, and sometimes it's a very superficial thing. And I know you didn't mean it when you said it, and I don't mean, we're not sitting here saying superficial in a judgmental way. We're saying a lot of times.
Oh, no, you couldn't You can see my inverted comma fingers. Inverted comma fingers, superficial. It could be a really important thing for them. Their tight hamstrings could be limiting them from having a pain-free life. But from our perspective as yoga teachers, we see, you know, the full 360-degree depth and richness of the yoga practice. And we want people to be wanting all of those benefits, to have, you know, mental stillness and calm, to have clarity, to have a spiritual compass. We want them to be physically healthy and emotionally balanced and and all of those wonderful things. And so if somebody comes and says, I want to be able to touch my toes, yeah, it's only a small part of the practice, but it still opens the door, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important to be, you know, open to different styles. Like I do find that, at least in my experience, most people find vinyasa, especially power or hot vinyasa, first. Because a lot of people tend to be, you know, in the Western world, they tend to be very competitive and type A and stressed out. And there is this idea of no pain, no gain. You know, if I don't sweat, I'm not doing anything beneficial. So a lot of times people find their yoga door through vinyasa. And as their practice grows, they start to shift into other styles like yin or restorative because they are seeing the benefits of that as well.
And I was talking with a private client a couple of weeks ago to say that most of the clients that I work with one-on-one, it's almost as if they've hit rock bottom and this is their last resort. And in some ways that sounds kind of sad or negative, but in other ways it's really opening and freeing, because if they were in less pain, they would probably be off doing vinyasa or power or hatha or bikram or ashtanga. And it's only because pain has sort of limited their options that they're suddenly open to other alternatives like yin yoga, like meditation, like pranayama, even just a more simple and basic physical practice. And it's incredible what potential those really simple things have to change your life. But sometimes you need the other options to be taken away before you're open to the subtlety.
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I think it's the way that we live our lives, you know, this instant gratification society. We want the results immediately. We want something tangible at the end. And sometimes, because we're so focused on that, we miss the subtle work that's being done. And, you know, I mean, I don't mean to keep going back to Tiffany and what she teaches, but that's one of my favorite parts of her teaching, is especially when I, you know, I'm with her in person, is when she has us sit and find something really specific to focus on. Like, lay on your back, close your eyes, and breathe, and see if you can relax all the muscles around your spine. Like, it's something that feels really foreign and far away because we don't really focus on it that much. And then here you have this person who is making you lay on your back for 5 minutes and breathe and telling you to feel what surrounds your spine and see if you can relax it.
She's really good at building on sort of layer upon layer upon layer, isn't she? So no matter who you are or where you're at, you can take something specific away from her practice, whether it was the first 5 minutes of really quiet and introspective stuff, whether it's the last 5 minutes of meditation, whether it's the peak of the vinyasa, the complicated flow that you talked about earlier. She's really good at putting layers so that there's something for everybody, no matter how strong they're feeling on that day, no matter how relevant that issue is to what's going on in their lives. She's a real inspiration as a teacher, isn't she?
Yeah, so why did you choose to go on to a 500-hour program?
Yeah, good question. Well, I'd done my 200-hour, and I was really lucky that my 200-hour program was fantastic. You know, I've talked to a lot of teachers who aren't happy. Retrospectively, they look back at their 200-hour and go, God, you know, we didn't even focus on teaching, or we had no philosophy, or we did no anatomy. And I feel like I was very lucky that my program was quite balanced. And so we walked out with a bit of Sanskrit, a bit of anatomy, a bit of pranayama, a bit of meditation, a bit of philosophy, some modifications for different population groups, some hands-on adjustments. And we were kind of open to a pretty big spectrum of things. But it did mean that we didn't go in-depth in any one particular area. So we all kind of walked out going, I know I'm interested in X, Y, and Z, and I want to learn more in that direction. So I'd been teaching, I think, for about 2 years when I started thinking, right, it's time for me to start looking for more training so that I can, you know, kind of boost up the areas where I'm weak and explore some of the areas that I know less about. And when I started looking around, gosh, there are so many options, aren't there? But from the bottom end of New Zealand, everywhere is expensive to go to, and everything requires a pretty big commitment of money and time. And at the time, Tiffany was in the process of moving to Australia to work with Duncan Peake from Power Living, and they ran a 7-day retreat together about sequencing. So he was teaching philosophical sequencing, she was teaching anatomical sequencing, and it just seemed like too good an opportunity to miss. And I thought, you know, Power Living, they're just over in Australia. That would be a really easy 500 hours for me. I know they're a good, solid school, and they're close, and it would be cheap to get there, so I'll go and check that training out. I don't know who this Tiffany Cruikshank is, but you know, she looks fine. We'll go to this retreat. So I went to the retreat, and almost immediately fell in love with Tiffany's style of teaching. And it really spoke to me because Duncan Peake is a fantastic teacher, but he is this huge personality. He has incredible presence, and I don't have any presence.
Well, I don't know about that, but
I'm just a normal person. I'm just a regular person. So I guess it really made me think. In my head, I had always thought that a yoga teacher had to be almost theatrical, like someone who is capable of grabbing and holding attention and commanding respect. And I guess in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I'm never going to be very good as a yoga teacher because I don't have that. I'm that sort of introverted, kind of geekier. You know, even the jokes I tell are pretty bad jokes. and I found Tiffany's style of teaching really freeing because it's not based on her personality. It's based on her sharing her knowledge and creating an environment where you can take from that what suits you, what serves you. And so it kind of opened my eyes up to a whole new way of teaching that was less personality-led and much more knowledge-driven. And so I left that 7-day retreat having signed up with Yoga Medicine and thinking, I don't know how long it will take me. It will probably take me 10 years to be, you know, saving up money and then going away for a module and then saving up money and going away for a module. But I don't care because this is the school that really speaks to me. And at that stage, it was Tiffany Yoga. It wasn't yet Yoga Medicine. So that was my first retreat. It was a joint one between Tiffany and Power Living, Duncan Peake. And then the next one was in Bali. And that was a year and a half later. It took me that long to save up for another module. And then after that, I sold my house, and that provided the money for the next module. And then I sold my investment property, and that provided the money for the next module. So I don't have any more houses to sell. So who knows how I'm going to pay for the next module after this one. It really spoke to me. It was an easy pick because I felt like I had really found my tribe. I'd found my people. And I felt really comfortable with the Yoga Medicine crowd of people. Mm.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I think is amazing, too, and super exciting is, you know, now that you've been asked to be an assistant, I mean, you started off not really even knowing much about Tiffany. And, you know, the first time that you met her, you were instantly connected. And now you get to participate in a different way than you probably ever thought you would be.
It is an incredible opportunity. I still can't quite believe it because, you know, I'm living in this tiny little town at the arse end of the world. You know, we're so far away from everywhere. And it's incredible to think that from here, from this little place where I've moved purely for lifestyle reasons, I'm still able to access and participate in world-class teaching, and I'm still able to progress my career. It really is unbelievable. I'm so fortunate. Yeah, I'm really, really lucky. And it was as if I'd been trying to compromise all this time. I'd been thinking, you know, I need to find a program that's close to me. I need to find one that's cheap that I can afford to go to. And as soon as I committed to something that I really believed in, even if I didn't know how I was going to do it, doors started opening. And I had an incredible, once I'd started working with Yoga Medicine and learning a bit more, I started to get these private clients. And one of my clients, this absolutely amazing woman, really inspiring. She gave me a tip that paid for the next module after the after the one that was paid for by the house. So it was just kind of the more open I was, the more clear I was about what I wanted, the more opportunities materialized. And it's funny, just that clarity, I think, made it possible for me to have the opportunities that I have had. And yeah, once Tiffany asked me to assist, that's definitely pressure, because the travel is still expensive, but it's a lot less expensive than paying for the travel and paying for the module.
Yeah,
so
for
from
sure.
From a purely selfish perspective, it means I get to keep training. And from a less selfish perspective, it means that I'm exposed to an incredible level of training that I can bring back to this little community and share. So, yeah, I'm incredibly lucky, really, really lucky.
Well, and I think, too, you know, also acknowledge what you bring to yoga medicine. I mean, the assistants that come, and they work so hard at what you guys have to do, and it's sort of your friendly faces, I think, that help keep the rest of us grounded and feeling comfortable and confident about what we're learning. And you know, you guys are also accessible, so I think that you are definitely an asset for the team, and I think that you bring a lot to you know, the pool of assistants that are there.
Well, that's really lovely to hear. Thank you.
Yeah,
I think Tiffany's trainings can be quite intimidating because, you know, it's not like a yoga holiday. Even though we're often somewhere quite beautiful, there are high expectations of us, you know, that she wants us to come and take in quite a lot of information and then to be able to turn that into work that we would do with our clients or with our students. So I think there'd be a potential there for our trainings to be quite intimidating, quite mm-hmm. full on. So it is really important that we're also a family, that we're also really friendly, and it's not about being perfect. It's about us figuring a way to get there together. It's not about, you know, whether we're passing or failing. It's a matter of us all finding a way to learn so that our students can benefit. So yeah,
definitely.
We are really friendly.
Yes, all of you are. And I think, too, like, this is the last one that we just did in May. It's my third, you know, sort of training with her. And it was the first time that I didn't, like, hit a wall and I didn't feel uncomfortable and all of that jazz. You know, it took my third trip to a training with her to feel more confident. But the other thing, too, which she's not like she's ever going to listen to this, so it's not, she won't know this, but and I would never tell her this, but I feel like she could charge more than she does. The amount of information that we get, I mean, and I tell people this about this training all the time, is literally like she lifts the top of her head off and pours all of it out. And it's unbelievable to me how much I learn when I'm at the trainings that she holds.
Yeah, she is really generous with her knowledge, isn't she?
Yeah.
But I think that's her passion. I think that's what gets Tiffany out of bed in the morning is she seems to love learning, and then how can she share what she's learned in a way that's helpful to people? And I think that's her concern much more so than being famous or being rich or being really well-known. I think her aim is to create a bridge between the yoga world and the medical world so that we're all more open to sharing the knowledge that we've got. I think that's what drives her. So I think she's just trying to cover her costs as opposed to making it a real money-making venture.
Yeah, I think so too. And I just think that we are fortunate to be able to be a part of that community. But I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I wanted to ask you a couple more questions before we finish. So first, what do you think, I always ask the teachers that I interview, if you could give 3 to 5 tips for someone who wants to try yoga or advice for somebody who's never done yoga, what would those be?
If you can afford it, I would say start with 1 or 2 private sessions. If you've never done yoga before, just to have someone take you through step by step what you can expect and what it means when we say, you know, breathe into your heart or breathe into your left hip or to take you through what's going to happen to you through the course of a class. What's the intention of the beginning? What's the intention of the middle part? What's the intention of the end? And if that's not accessible to you, which it probably isn't to the vast majority of people, then I would say go to a class that is specifically for beginners, or a very slow-moving practice like yin yoga, where you'll really have time to explore what you're feeling and what you're thinking, as opposed to just following the person next to you or following the person in front of you. Arrive early so that you have time to have a look around, to figure out, you know, where's the front of the room, where's the side of the room, what do people do with the props, how do they set up their mats. Go with a friend who already knows the studio. That can make it a little bit less intimidating. And I guess my final tip, I've got two more. Gosh, this is really second last tip would be ask questions. You know, even if it's during class, because, you know, yoga classes can be quite a serious, if you're not in my class, can be quite a serious environment, and it can feel intimidating to ask a question. But even if you just kind of wave at the teacher or gesture them over, ask rather than assume. You know, gosh, my knee's hurting like crazy here, but I don't want to say anything. Ask the question. You know, and if they give you a blanket and your knee still hurts, say, actually, it still hurts. Is there anything else I could do to stop it hurting? So, yeah, I would say ask questions, even if you do it quietly and, you know, just wave them over one-on-one. And then the last piece of advice would be, if you go and you hate it, try another style of practice, try a different teacher, because there are a million different pathways in the yoga world, and there is one that's perfect for you. You just have to find it. Does that make sense? So I had a student, for example, who started with me in dynamic hatha, and, you know, I'm a decent teacher, but she just wasn't enjoying it very much. She found the body weight on the arms really challenging, and I said, look, why don't you try Bikram? It's right next door. It's on at the same time. You never know. Try a class. And I never saw her in my class again. She loves Bikram. She loves the heat. She loves the mirrors. She loves the fact that it's the same postures every time, so she knows what's coming. She knows what's expected. So, you know, even if you're going to a good studio and a good teacher, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the perfect one for you right now. Don't hesitate to try a different style or a different type of class or a different teacher, because there will be something that you love.
I think that's great advice, and I try to give similar advice, I think. It's really important to, and I say this at the beginning of my classes, I always tell people that if there's new people in my class, people who come all the time know, everyone has the power to stop the class at any point and say, I am so lost, yeah, or what you're saying doesn't make sense. Like, I'd rather people do that than, you know, suffer
than
along.
Have to see blank faces. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it does. I think if you're new to studios especially, say you've practiced in a gym before, gyms have a particular feeling, but you go to a studio and there might be a statue of Buddha, or, you know, one of our studios has a painting of Ganesh, or there are little chimes or people om. That can be kind of scary if you're new to a yoga world and you think, oh, you know, I'll do it wrong or I'll say the wrong thing. But don't let that environment intimidate you. You know, they're just symbols, just, you know, it's all just people at the end of the day. So ask. Ask if you're not sure. Don't be scared. Don't do anything that doesn't make you comfortable. But just be open. Maybe it'll make you more comfortable in 6 months or a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really great advice. So thank you for that. I think it's really helpful for people to hear that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about was your retreat. Why did you decide to do this? Why Tonga? What is the point of all of this? And what was your inspiration, and what do you hope to accomplish?
A really good question. It's been a really fascinating couple of years. That about the same time that the opportunity came up to assist yoga medicine, a couple of my students approached me and said, would you like to teach a retreat for us? We do small group travel, and, you know, we're thinking of doing a yoga retreat, and we would love you to teach for us. Would you think about it? And I'd been, for the last sort of 5 years, renovating my house and working three jobs and studying, and I'd been really head down, bum up for a long time. And one of the things that I was really clear that I wanted to do was to travel more, to open my eyes and open my doors and open my heart and get out and travel a bit more. And Yoga medicine was a part of that, but it was if, you know, once the doors opened, it was like the floodgates opened. So this lovely couple said, let's catch up, we'll have a coffee, we'll have a talk about the possibility of you running a retreat with us. And when we did, they said, we know a fantastic place in Tonga, you can swim with the whales, we would love you to run a retreat there. So it's not that Tonga has come from my background, I've actually never been there before. It was just that these two they're a really cool couple. They live here in Queenstown, but they spend a lot of the year traveling, and they're not ridiculously wealthy. They just make it happen. They're really passionate about exploring and traveling and adventuring, and so the location is their choice and it's their passion. And I'm going to be as excited about participating as the yoga students are. I've never swum with whales before. I've never been to Tonga before. But what I really like about this retreat is that it's very unhurried and unrushed. So we'll do yoga twice a day. We have three or four opportunities to swim with the whales. We do a visit into a local village to get a taste of some of their culture. But there's lots of spare time. So yeah, we'll get to sleep and walk on the beach and read books and talk and look at the stars and all of the things that you want to do on holiday that so often you don't. You know, you go away on a holiday and you come back exhausted going, oh, wow, I need a holiday to recover from my holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I like about this retreat. It's really simple. The retreat that we're staying in is run by a lady who sounds like quite an eccentric American who's relocated herself to a tiny little isolated island in Tonga, and there's no power and no Wi-Fi at the accommodation. You know, you can take your phone, you can charge it up at the generator at the main house, but it's all kind of back to basics. Unplug from the craziness of life and just have a more leisurely pace, have a bit more perspective, and yeah, hopefully come back to the real world a little bit changed. I mean, I can't imagine swimming with humpback whales without having a bit of a perspective shift.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really excited. I'm also quite nervous because I've never run a multi-day retreat before. I've only ever had single-day retreats. So this, for me, it'll be quite a big step up in terms of my teaching. So I'm nervous, but I'm excited at the same time.
Well, I think you're going to be great. One of the things that
I think we can have a wonderful, yeah,
I think it'll be great, and I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. And one of the things that always strikes me about you when I see you is that you do have a really strong presence, and it's kind of this like quiet steadiness that's very dependable. And so you always make me feel very grounded when I am with you. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I do feel like it's almost like you're psychic. At the points in our modules where I start to feel a little bit uncertain and shaky, I always see you sitting next to me when we're in our training classes. And I'm like, oh, there's Rachel. She must know that I need some of her energy.
Everything is going to be fine.
Yeah, that's always how it feels.
That is really sweet. Yeah, I think it's going to be an amazing week. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be an incredible experience, but I'm hoping quite a grounding and humbling experience. I can't imagine swimming with a humpback whale and walking away feeling self-important. So I'm hoping that we come back from Tonga just with a really renewed appreciation of, gosh, how lucky we are and how vulnerable this world is, and how important it is that we all move through it with a bit more awareness and a bit more mindfulness, you know, not just for each other but for the planet and for the other species that live on it. This is all sounding very heavy. We're going to have a lovely holiday too.
Well, you know what we should do is... when you get back and you've had some time to reacclimate to the real, because it's going to be overwhelming, you know, to come back from being isolated and then come back to the real world, and you'll feel a little bit shift. I think it'll take a little bit to adjust back to.
Well, the interesting thing is I'm going straight from Tonga to Mexico to assist my first 200-hour for yoga medicine. So the whole
Living
journey for
with
me is going to
Wi-Fi.
be new stuff. Yeah, I'm nervous about that too because I haven't done a yoga medicine 200-hour, and I imagine it being quite different to mine. And I'll be teaching some of the content. So yeah, I'm terrified about the whole thing. But most things in life that I've been terrified of have worked out really well. So, because I'm only scared if it means something. If it's not
Right.
important to me, there's nothing to be scared of. But it's really important to me. So I think the fear will help me focus on what's important. Yeah, what do I really want to accomplish or achieve? What do I really want to experience? But yeah, it's going to be quite an interesting September, October. And I imagine by the time I come back home again, I'll be probably, I will have had a quantum shift. I'm sure of it. I'll be a slightly different person on the other side of the
Yeah.
retreat and the teaching. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we can do another one when you get back, and we can share all the
Yeah,
stuff
that
that
would be
you've
really.
learned.
I can talk about swimming with the whales.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Well, I don't want to keep you much longer because I know that you have. It's amazing though that we can do this, even though your tomorrow is today for you.
Even though my toilet flushes the opposite way from how yours flushes, I know technology is incredible. I've done maybe two or three Kundalini classes in my entire life, and one of them, the teacher at the end said, "Technology is incredible. You could be using your iPhone to follow, the Kardashians on social media, or you could use your iPhone to access the sum total of human knowledge, the scriptures." The text, all of the wisdom that has distilled over the ages, we have that potential in the palm of our hand these days. And I'm reminded by that sometimes because you can use technology for stupid and pointless things, but you can use technology for incredible things. I mean, you probably don't remember this because you're quite a bit younger than me, but there was a Sandra Bullock movie. I can't remember what it was called. Back in the early 90s when the internet was just coming out and people thought that once you were on the internet, you'd never leave your house. Everyone would just stay home and order pizza online and work from home, and humans would stop interacting. But instead, we've used the internet to interact with more people than ever before. We have friends scattered all over the globe. And to me, that's really, it inspires a lot of hope because if we continue choosing that path of connection and of recognizing connections between us rather than differences between us, it's the right way for the world to go, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I hope that's what people use it for, and I hope that I'm just very emotional, and I have lots of feelings that can be very overwhelming at times, and I've been that way my whole life. And part of my charm, but also part of the downfall or one of the bad sides of my personality. And I get really overwhelmed with the access to information sometimes, and it makes me very sad, to see all the bad things that happen in the world. But as I'm reminded all the time from my partner, he always says to me, "There's a million good things that happen in a day that you just don't hear about." Because that's what not what people
Yeah.
put on the internet, and
Yeah.
so for me, like it's definitely something that is a reminder of reality, but it's also a way for me to stay connected to the things that I love and that the people that are important to me and the people who make me give me inspiration and make me feel normal. And Facebook especially, like I know that Facebook people hate it, but I'm able to interact with
Don't
as a
waste your
result of
energy,
it.
people. Don't waste your energy hating Facebook.
Yeah.
I think there's so much in the world that we can't control, and there's no
Yeah.
point freaking out about the stuff that we can't control. We've got to focus on what we can control. And when it comes to the internet, Facebook, Instagram, you get to choose what you focus on, what content you respond to, how you spend your time. And if each of us keep choosing the connection, if we keep choosing hope, if we keep choosing the positive, that's all we can do in life, and we have to hope that that's enough. I choose to believe that it will be enough. But that said, it's a beautiful sunny Friday morning. I've finished work for the week. No wonder I'm feeling optimistic for you. It's late on a
Yeah,
Thursday night. You're probably tired. But that's all we can do. We can only control our own choices, and if we keep making positive choices, then that's all we can do.
Yeah, no, I agree. I completely agree. But, well, I want to let you go because I know you have your whole Friday ahead of you. I don't want to thwart any fun activities that you may have. But thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here and for taking the time out of your day. I really appreciate it, and I think that you've given so much of yourself today and that it'll be really beneficial for the people who listen.
Oh, thank you. I'm really pleased to be asked, and I think you probably underestimate the positive power that you have in the world too. You know, maybe you don't see it, but all of the choices that you're making are really positive ones, and you're putting a lot of good information and good intention out into the world, not just locally, but all over the world, all over social media and through your podcasts. So, yeah, you're being a power for good in the world, and you should recognize that, I think.
Well, I appreciate that, Rachel. It means a lot coming from you.
It's a pleasure. It's been really nice to chat to you. It's nice to have an excuse to chat to you.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to do it more often.
Yeah.
But thank you for listening, guys, and join us again on our next podcast. Thank you.